I don't know that anybody here has been at a talk where I've used them, but I apologize if that's so. Oh, and actually, we see the slide also on the screen. Okay, so what I'd like to do is jump to a contemporary point of view about relationalism, and so and I'd like to go through this a little bit critically. So this is what I think that I mean when I say that the world is relational, or I believe that the world is relational. I mean, some people know the history, for some people it's new. So let me just say there was, from my generation working in quantum gravity, there was a very healthy interaction with certain philosophers and historians of physics. A number of them, but starting off, John Stachel and Julian Barber, who really made an impression on those of us working in the field of quantum gravity, and did so by convincing us what the correct interpretation of general relativity, and that the correct interpretation of general relativity is what might be called the relational or a-relational interpretation. My impression is that that view, which is now pretty widely held among people working in classical general relativity and quantum gravity, is not universally held by philosophers, even though it came to us through the intercession of some philosophers. And I'll discuss that when I get to it. I also have a sense that that this is an issue which earlier generations of people who worked in relativity did not think about the same. And so, for example, there's this curious feature that up to the book of Carlo Rovelli, which is really a textbook in quantum gravity, none of these discussions or these issues are reflected, to my knowledge, in any textbook in general relativity. And there's also a long history of rather confused discussions about the meaning of general covariance and so forth, which this point of view sharpens up. So anyway, this is a kind of presentation, and again, I'll ask for comments often and expect to be criticized. So this is a physicist, and it's, a physicist version of relationalism. So it starts with the observation that the world is made up of a large number of entities or events. Otherwise would not be interesting. Otherwise we would not be here, et cetera, but otherwise would not be interesting. And the key question is, how do the entities or the events that make up the world get their properties? And here, whatever confusion there may have been between Newton and Leibniz and so forth, there's a clear distinction between two different ways that entities, say a particle, could get properties. That is, you could, you know, if I believe that the world has particles in it, I could believe that the position of a particle with respect to absolute space is meaningful, and I could believe that the trajectory of a particle in absolute space with respect to absolute time is meaningful or not. And if I believe it's meaningful, then formally what we're doing is we're making use of some entities which we believe exist, that is, absolute space and absolute time, to give meaning to properties of dynamical objects like particles. And therefore, absolute space is playing a role, we can later analyze how necessary a role, et cetera, but at least a role in the language and the belief that we have about those particles, that is that they, it's meaningful and real to say that they have positions and those positions are with respect to absolute space. So for example, a consequence of that is that a particle has the same potential properties if it's the only particle in the universe, if it's one of three particles in the universe, or if it's one of 10 to the 80 particles in the universe, its potential properties are still its position and changes in time of its position. Yeah.
The Newton believes that there is an absolute finite state there, but specifically that we can measure or observe it, this kind of absolute thing, or it just believe that there is something absolute there, but
so
absolute there we play a role in, and in Newton's meaning the laws of the physics.
So Newton seems to have recognized that what we measure are relative positions.
Yeah.
Okay. But still, he believed in the meaning of absolute positions to formulate the laws of motion.
Yeah.
Okay. So the claim that I'm making here, so I'm really here, follow me, I'm making a definition of what I mean by a relational approach to physics, a relational view of physics. So follow me here. Okay. Everybody agrees that you can only measure relative positions and relative motions. Okay. But nonetheless, one might still believe that the properties of a particle were primarily its position in absolute space and its motion through absolute space in absolute time. And before I write down any coordinate system or anything like that, I might just believe that. Okay. Now, a entity, I want to just give a language, an entity which plays the role of giving dynamical entities properties, you could call an absolute entity. So absolute space, the way it's being used here, absolute time, the way it's being used here, has no dynamics itself, doesn't satisfy a law of motion, doesn't change, but serves to give properties to entities which do have dynamics. So let's call such things absolute entities. And let's call the collection of all such absolute entities the background. Okay, so this is just language. And by the way, this can be applied, you know, in areas other than physics. And maybe it'll be too much of distracting to do so, but there's a similar discussion, say, in economic theory. You know, when which you try to discuss what the meaning of a price is. And there's a similar discussion to be had about whether there is an absolute meaning of a price of something in an economy, which its real price approximates, that is, its price on any given day approximates and so forth. Okay, but that's maybe a discussion for another day. What?
That's what brings
in Rippendorf. Well, no. There is a discourse, to use an academic term, there is a discussion about whether the instabilities in financial markets are due to wrong economic modeling based on wrong economic theories. And the people who talk about that raise issues which are analogous to the issues that we're raising here. So I'm not kidding when I say that there's an analogy. Okay, let's go on with physics. So these absolute entities make up the background. Okay. So the most basic statement of relationalism is there is no background. So there are no entities which are non-dynamical, which serve to give properties to things that are dynamical. So, you know, the point being illustrated, if you have a system of many particles in three dimensions, you might believe that, so I labels the particles and A labels the dimension, you might believe that all these as a function of time are real properties of the particles if you're an absolutist, or if you believe in the existence of space. Or you might believe that the only thing that has reality are the distances, which are the distances between the positions of the particles. And you might believe that only these are real properties. Okay. If you disbelieve in the possibility of using non-dynamical idealized entities to give properties to dynamical entities, you would be skeptical about these properties, but you would not be skeptical about these properties. So that's the distinction. Yes, right, right. Although you might say that in the reference frame of some observer, Dij, you can measure the xi and the xj in a coordinate system. These would all be relative distances. And then you could compute this. Okay.
Something that really has no dynamics.
Yes. Yeah. That this, I'm making an extreme distinction for clarity here. But I'm going to maintain that part. Okay. So how do we understand the properties of elementary particles? So the relational view posits that the fundamental properties of the elementary particles or elementary entities entirely consist in relationships between them. So all the what that means is that there are no properties of the form of property of the ith particle. Every property is of the form of some relationship between I and J, or maybe even some relationship amongst three particles. Okay. So that's another claim that relationalism, it's another version of the statement of relationalism. You might see it as a consequence of the first one, that there is no background. Okay. So it's interesting to notice that mathematics makes available a number of systems which are really relational, which are as relational as you would like, and some which are partly relational. So a graph, and by this I mean a combinatorial graph, not embedded in any space, is a relational world. And so what I mean by that is that I noticed I didn't label these points. So what I mean by a graph is I have n points and I give a list of which pairs are connected. So some pairs may be connected and some pairs may not be connected. And the configuration space of the system is all possible sets of pairs which are connected. So any graphically you draw n points in any way of drawing or not drawing lines between pairs of them is a graph. And in a relational world described by a graph, the points don't have names. So the identity of this point, say as distinct from this point or this point, by points I mean the vertex, lies in their being connected to the rest of the graph differently. So if I want to be technical about this, let me just say. So one way to describe a graph is by an adjacency matrix. So Mij equals, so I have a matrix Mij, and Mij equals 1 if vertex I is connected to J, and 0 if they're not connected. And the properties are really in Mij mod the permutations. There's all the permutations of the rows and the columns, because there's no labels, there's no meaning to the first graph, the first point of the graph or the second point of the graph, and so forth. And graphs are interesting ways to illustrate, for example, Leibniz speak. For example, supposing I drew this graph, or I specified this graph, in terms of relationships, there's no way to distinguish this vertex from this vertex because they both have, they're tied to the graph in exactly the same ways. And if you believed in the principle of sufficient reason, then you would believe that there's no reason why some entity might live here. Imagine that other properties that nodes can have is that people live on them or something. But there would be no reason to live here rather than here because there's a symmetry in the graph, and there's also happens to be a symmetry this way. So there's no reason why you would live here rather than here. And so Leibniz also talked about another principle called the principle of the identity of the indiscernible. Which means that we should identify those entities which have the same relations, which are indistinguishable by their relations to the rest of the world. So actually, rather than having four nodes, in reality, as you know, this really just has two, and it really just looks like that. Yes. Very good. Very good. Thank you. So, in fact, it's just this. Thank you.
No, but I mean, in the first place, you had two distinguishable nodes. Now you have only one node there.
But I was accepting your criticism. Maybe I accepted your criticism a little bit too quickly.
The bottom loop shouldn't have been there.
No, so what I was trying to illustrate was that there was a path between this node and this node, which is there. There was a path between this node and this node, which is however itself. And there's a path between this node. Oh, that's right. You're right. Thank you so much.
Okay.
So that's what I mean by a graph as a relational system, or what's sometimes called a combinatorial graph. Another relational system is a partially ordered set. A partially ordered set is a set on which between any two entities, either you can write A is greater than B, B is greater than A, or you don't have to have any relation at all. We physicists like to think of partially ordered sets in terms of time. So this is a discrete set of events with some causal relations amongst them. And this is the basis for the causal set approach to space-time and quantum gravity. And it's interesting that this is also an entirely relational system. It has no meaning except as a set of relationships. Okay. So the possibility of constructing models of the world which are entirely relational is not empty. That's what I'm trying to illustrate. In fact, people who work on causal sets posit that, in fact, we can get our whole world from a set of partial orders. Now, there are partly relational systems like links and knots. So if the world is three-dimensional,
and we're just doing the topology of the world, there's a there's an interesting mathematical subject, which is classifying the topologically distinct ways that closed loops can be embedded in three-dimensional space. If there's just one, then those are knots, and if there's more than one, then those are links, such as this. And these do make use of a background, that is, the topology of three-dimensional space plays a role here. You couldn't say without the topology of three-dimensional space that these two circles, which are embedded in three-dimensional space, are linked or not. So this is an example where there is a background. There is a background structure given properties, but afterwards, all the properties of the entities are relational, all the properties. And that's an interesting, I show that both to show that there really are cases which are partly relational, and clear mathematical structures which are partly relational. And there's a lot of beautiful, interesting structure there. Now, interestingly enough, all three of these relational and partly relational structures play roles in different approaches to quantum gravity, coming from quantizing general relativity. So, and it's interesting that they are, in fact, the things that arise over and over again in different approaches to quantum gravity tend to be either dynamics of graphs, partially ordered sets, or the dynamics of knots and links. So, what is time in such an approach? So this is really just taking Leibniz for his definition that time is just succession, but putting a little more structure in. If space is a set of relationships, so if space is relationships of nodes being connected or not, as would be given by a graph, and then time could be changes in those relationships. So the graph could evolve from here, say, by adding another node which was attached like that, and then it could add another node who was attached like that, and then it could add an edge there, and those are all a succession of different graphs. So there could be a succession of structures which are space, which are relationships, and the ordering of them would correspond to time, according to Leibniz. And even in, for example, in loop quantum gravity, there's a set of local, there's a loop quantum gravity employs both graphs and their embeddings in three-dimensional space. Dynamics is given by local changes on the graphs. For example, two nodes may switch their connections. And the succession of local changes, starting with an initial graph and then changing it with such local changes, the local changes make a partially ordered set where you say that a change B is to the future of a change A if it involves something which was created. So if you went to, this was event A, and now, let's say these were connected elsewhere, and now we took this node and this node to do the same thing. So we now, I lost one. No, I think that's fine. We now go to, so I did a move in which I exchanged those two, and then I did a move where I exchanged those two. This second move B is to the future of this move A because it acted on a node which was created by node A. So we would say that node B is to the future of, I'm sorry, move B is to the future of the move A. So there's a partial order amongst them. Okay, so, so in fact, the simple picture is realized in loop quantum gravity and similar fictions.
What happens to Lorentz transformations?
What happens is Lorentz transformations are not easy to see because you would need a state that you knew corresponded to a flat space time. But what there is the analog of many finger time. There's the fact that if I over here did some move over here which didn't overlap this move, and that move is space-like to this move, and then it's space-like to this move. So we would say that there was no meaningful causal order amongst them, and therefore one could have made this one first, and then these two, or this one, and then this one, and this one. So this corresponds to
Heurism,
yes. Well, and more precisely, in general relativity, we push forward. Remember the picture that we've drawn 100 times, in which we have space-like slice, and we push it forward, and we could push it forward different ways. So we could evolve to this slice, or to this slice, by using our Hamiltonian constraints. So that's what's called many-finger time, and that certainly survives here. And that's related to the fact that the set of moves make a partial order and not a total order. Okay. So, other questions? Comments, questions? Okay. Of course, one can argue that one can't be absolute about absoluteness or about the distinction between absoluteness and relationalism. That is, I've made this assertion that relationalism means getting rid of the background, and I define the background to be certain, entities which don't change. But there are a lot of things that you could criticize remain. If I use the Hilbert space, the geometry of the Hilbert space is not changing and time is not dynamical. The fact is that if I use real numbers for probabilities, the real number line is not changing. The laws, if I have some rules by which I change the graphs, those rules are not changing, so maybe they should be considered part of the background, because when they're not, the rules are not the results of some dynamics. They're defining the system. So in the face of that kind of criticism, one can retreat to what you might call a relational strategy, in which this is a research strategy. That is, you should, it seems to be, to have been good advice on a number of occasions in physics to seek to make progress by identifying absolute entities that play the role of the background in your current physical theory and seek to replace them with posited real interactions with posited real physical entities. So that rather than positing that the geometry of space just is always fixed three-dimensional, flat three-dimensional Euclidean space without any law or dynamics determining it, we go to general relativity where the dynamics of the world includes dynamics which allows the geometry to change and evolve, and in which if the world looks very Euclidean in our neighborhood, that's the result, that's a property of the solution in a particular time. So that's another meaning of relationalism as a kind of strategy. Science. Yes.
So we hear it, because you said that for the time is kind of the change of the order, the change of the relations. If, for example, at a certain time, the relations changing somehow, that two points are going to be equal, like that we have for this, what's happened then?
Well, that's an interesting question. So supposing I have some set of, so what you're saying is the problem, supposing I start with the graph, by the principle of identity being discernible, every node is distinct, and I proceed to evolve by local rules, and I evolve to a situation where all of a sudden there's a symmetry.
Yeah.
And, you're asking very good questions. I if you were a purist about the about the identity being discernible, I guess you would say that all of a sudden those two nodes became the same node. So, for example, you might say in general relativity. So, you might say, as I argued before, the observables of general relativity are relational observables. And I mentioned before the Google Universe observables, where you decide where you are by what your picture of the sky looks like at any time, and posit that we live in a universe which is diverse enough that from no two space-time points is the sufficiently detailed picture of the sky that is the light coming in from the back of the black hole the same. But supposing that all of a sudden as we move along, it just happened accidentally that two points had the same sky. If you really are a purist about the identity of the indiscernible, you would say all of a sudden those two points have to be identified, you know, as if there were a wormhole there or something. Okay, and there are people who advocate that view. There are even people in this building who advocate that view. Not me. Well, I don't know. I don't know if I mean, I'm not on record about advocating that view, but that doesn't seem to me to be a crazy view. By a long shot. Okay. So let me just give a summary. So these are four things that relationalism could mean in the contemporary world. So one is the statement that there is no background. Two, that the fundamental properties of elementary entities consist entirely in relationships between those entities. Two is, roughly speaking, a consequence of one, because that means the only thing that the properties of a particle could be about are either somehow its intrinsic nature in itself, but this very poor set of properties that could be, or it's, they could involve its relationships with other entities. And three, if those relationships are not fixed, but there's law that guides their evolution, then the claim, a relational view is that time is just changes in those relationships and consists of nothing but the ordering amongst those changes. Pretty, with some caveats, different approaches to quantum gravity, like causal sets, loop quantum gravity, spin foam models, come close to achieving those definitions of relationalism. They do not, well, loop quantum gravity does not completely, because the states are not just graphs, the graphs embedded in topological free space. So there is a mixed, partly background and partly relational set of properties, but there are people who propose dropping the embedding in three space, so that there would be a purely relational structure. And causal sets is entirely relational according to those definitions. Then there are other approaches like causal dynamical triangulations, which are again partly to a good degree realize those. So these are not pie in the sky kinds of things. There are real research programs based on them. And it's interesting, and why I wanted to set up this lecture the way that I did, is that there's confusion about what Newton really meant, and we can discuss what Newton was really thinking and what Leibniz was really thinking, and how they misunderstood or understood each other. But at a sort of zero order, naive level, one can really see the current research programs in quantum gravity as in something like the Leibnizian or relational mode. And I think that that's interesting, and it's something that I have advocated, but in the context of this class, I want to critique. So I want, what I'd like to do in the next class is come back and critique and have you all come back and critique, because I've given a sort of production to relationalism. When one retreats from one, then retreats to this relational strategy, which is a different kind of idea. It's a methodological idea about how science works and science progresses. Okay, so let me pause for comments, discussion. Okay, so if you give me 5 more minutes, I'll give you my take of general relativity in this context. Want to tell us what general relativity really means? You're tired out. And this first comment is something that I got from David Finkelstein a long time ago when I was a student. So general relativity has, compared to what we were just talking about, is what Ida calls very rich mathematically or confusedly complex. That is, there are several layers of structure you get, as I emphasized before. So we have a differentiable manifold, which is a rather complex structure, this thing that I call M, which has a specification of dimension, topology, and differential structure built into it. And there's a lot of stuff going on there. The structure of the wheels, et cetera, but let's let that be. And then on top of that is the metric in the fields. And all the structure that goes under the name M is background structure, is absolute structure. We have no dynamics in general relativity which chooses the dimension. We have no dynamics which chooses the topology. We have no dynamics by which the topology evolves. If you pick a initial data with a certain 3 topology, that 3 topology stays there until the whole thing collapses by singularity according to the classical Einstein equations. There have been speculations about changing topology quantum mechanically, but not to classical general relativity. So that's all. And indeed, for any topology manifold in any dimension that you can write down above 3 spacetime equal to and above 3 spacetime dimensions, there is a version of general relativity with that manifold, that topology, etc. On the other hand, the metric and the other fields are argued to describe relational information because of the requirement of diffeomorphism invariance. So I take it, and this is something again, which the historical discussion seems to be confused. I'm not a scholar, but Einstein seems at times confused about this, although he really got the right answer. But the idea that a physical space-time, what I have here under the key point, is not a manifold metric in fields, but an equivalence class of those. By the diffeomorphism group of the space-time is not something that is stated in any general relativity textbook. It's not something in principle that I think was clearly enunciated before sometime in the 1980s by sort of generally in the community. Although again it's clear, and this is material we've gone through, that Dirac was aware of that. It's clear in Dirac's analysis of the role of the constraints that Dirac had in mind and gave an argument for precisely this correspondence. So this is what, and actually, so this is the way that I see general relativity. It is the subject of, there's a fixed background structure, and then there's a relational structure given by the metrics in the field on the background structure modulo of diffeomorphisms.
Yeah, kind of a creation of singularity using the changing of the.
It's not been, I'm not aware of it, that anybody has successfully seen the occurrence of singularity as a change in topology.
Yeah. So if I have a region of space-time that's almost flat, and I have a little gravitational wave packet moving through it, so is that little gravitational wave packet a physical entity?
Yes,
it is.
Yes.
So that then entity is, so then I normally describe that little packet by, say, GAB, right, or something like that. So, but then that says that at least the GAB is describing a little wave packet, is describing a physical entity. It's in some sense, it's distinguished from relational information.
Well, I don't think so. So it seems to me.
But I mean, in the slide before, you set up a distinction between physical entities and you know, relations between them.
Yes. Yeah, so
and now here I'm.
Can we go back?
Somewhere there's identifying, yeah, replacing them with relations between physical entities which involve subject to dynamical law. So there's a picture there of physical entities, and then some law that connects how these physical entities involve.
Yes, no. So you're. I think you're quite right. What I would say, what is real about a gravitational wave is not in the metric components as a function of coordinates. You're a little bit closer to it in the coordinates. I'm sorry, in the curvatures in various coordinates. But as we discussed before, the real observables in general relativity are not coordinate dependent because they're diffeomorphism invariant, and the two things are equal under diffeomorphisms. It's a consequence that they're equal under coordinate changes. And we don't have a simple closed form description of what a gravitational wave is in the generic case.
So in a simple case like just merely flat space time, nice little
So what I would do is
I would pack it. I mean, there's no way to describe, even in the classical theory, there's no way to identify that entity.
Let me back up. There are some ways to identify that entity if you allow me to put on a boundary. So for example, if it's nearly flat, and if it is flat, say, outside of some compact region, then I'm allowed to call upon the existence of the boundary of Minkowski space. And I'm allowed to use techniques where I look at the distortion of null geodesics as they go through this area where there's a gravitational wave and make a pattern of the null infinity. And I can describe it in invariant and precise language in terms of the impact it has on geodesics, the patterns of geodesics as they reach null infinity. Right?
But what about our universe, which presumably has no such boundary like that? What we'd like to believe that there are regions of space.
Oh,
there
are
little gravitational wave packets, and
John, I believe it, and I have the following resources to call on. Okay, what do we really do? Okay? What we really do in practice, okay, is we make an approximation in which we pretend that the gravitational wave is a field in Minkowski space-time. And we use the tools of Minkowski space-time, which allow us to give meaning to inertial measurements that we made by inertial observers, and we treat it as we would an electromagnetic wave. And that
doesn't practice, right?
That, of course, at some point breaks down, but we do that in practice. And many things we do in general relativity in practice make use of the fact that most situations of interest are either spacetimes which are highly symmetrical or approximately so, small deviations in spacetimes which are highly symmetrical, so we cheat. But that seems a little bit problematic. I mean, it's not, obviously no problem in terms of doing practical physics, but it seems you have to, it seems as if you have to rely on a theory that is incorrect to identify the ontology in a theory that is correct. It's almost bad. It's called mechanics. It's a quantum.
But here's the so my claim is that the ontology is fix a manifold and a differential structure, and then the ontology is metrics and fields on that mod diffeomorphism. That's an ontology for me. Now, if I push it, what is descriptive of that ontology, I think goes on here. There is the result of what David Malamud is one person who put it in a form which I don't remember, but that's not very coherent, sorry. Let me just state the fact. The fact is that the information in the metric, which is invariant, is the causal structure plus one function which can be seen as giving a physical volume to regions of space-time. So a way to describe the ontology in pictures, at least, is to start drawing causal relations and start drawing light cones. And then say that every time you have an intersection of a past light cone of some event and a future light cone of another event, giving us a region like that, I'm not drawing it very well, but you know what I mean, there is a volume of that. Okay. Satisfying the usual rules that a volume measure has to satisfy. Okay. And that is an ontology. Causal structure plus assignment of volumes just sets defined by causal. So I don't think there's a problem with ontology. There is a problem identifying two functions per space-time point, which clearly label, quote, the degrees of freedom. Because we know from counting, from analysis of the linearized theory, from counting solutions, that there are two degrees of freedom per space-time point. But a thing that we certainly don't have is a simple description of them in terms of functions of the metrics of curvatures because of the diffeomorphism invariants.
And a physical, sorry, if I just, the definition here now of a physical event?
I'm not sure. A physical event is a coincidence of four field values. That is, you want to know why I picked this out and why I picked this out. Mm-hmm. So I would now have to tell you a story about four functions, phi 1 to phi 4, which are themselves, which are scalar functions of components of curvature of the electromagnetic fields or like quantities, and which distinguish this event from any other event in the history of space time.
But those fields would not be the metric.
No. You can make them from powers of curvature and derivatives of curvature, and there are proposals to do that. But
okay. So then you could talk about gravitational wave packets in a language. What I'm trying to get at is whether I can think of, say, the collision of two gravitational wave packets. Is that a physical event?
These are all crucially good questions. Okay. And I don't know, I don't know a simple way in which there's an answer. Not one way I can answer your question. So much of what's known about general relativity is known about the asymptotically flat case.
Right.
So in the asymptotically flat case, I can draw you a causal diagram. I can talk about a wave packet traveling through the otherwise flat space-time. I can talk about another one traveling through an otherwise flat space-time.
And I can analyze the space-time and discover that there's a singularity there to the future of an event, which is, you know, whose future light cone is not flat. So everything in the future light cone of that event shows curvature, which is a residue of that collision.
Right, right.
Okay, so I can, in the asymptotically flat case, use some tools to talk in a invariant way about examples of such phenomena. So I believe that such phenomena exist in other causal structures, but they're much harder to get at. And much of the, you know, good work in general relativity about the problem of observables took place in the, you know, in the context of asymptotically flat structure and asymptotically flat space times, because it's possible there to get a handle. I mean, another, you know, there's a beautiful set of research by Ted Newman and collaborators where a space, if you have asymptotically flat space-time, that makes, so the light cone can be seen as a cylinder, and the future light cone of some event intersects that cylinder in a sphere. And by study of the relationships of these spheres on the cylinder, it's possible to talk about the relationships between the events that gave rise to them. And it's actually possible, from data on infinity on sufficiently nice spacetimes, to actually reconstruct the metric in the interior in some certain set of coordinates as a function of the data on scribe class. And that's called the heaven construction, the heavenly space construction. And that is a use of diffeomorphism in the brain, you know, relational information, you know, tamed, because at infinity everything becomes linearized. And so some background structure, if you go far enough away from certain kinds of space-times, some background structure emerges. There's a certain geometrical structure which emerges on the future, on scribe class, which is the place that null rays go to, and you can use that structure to anchor observables.
And you don't see this problematic that's so linked to the asymptotic.
I do see it as problematic. And, but, so I think that last time I characterized two different ways observables in general relativity in the compact case. So you could have two kinds of issues. You could say, three kinds of issues. You could say those observables are impossible to compute, okay, in the generic case. And here, depending on what your view is of, you know, sort of uncomputable mathematical objects or hard to compute mathematical objects, you could worry or not worry. You could worry about those observables. You could worry about their adequacy. That is, I made lots of assumptions about the existence of functions which invert the equations of motion. You could worry that there's a lot that was not demonstrated, etc. I guess that those are the two words. I don't know. I'm caught between these things. The question is there going to be a future classical theory of gravity which is not expressed in the form of something like diffeomorphisms? I don't know. It's hard for me to foresee that. My guess is no. That is, I don't think this is like the foundational issues of quantum mechanics that
right.
You could look forward to illumination. Can you look forward to illumination from a possible quantum theory of gravity? Maybe. Maybe. Other comments, questions?
Yes.
I don't know if you read the word to the table, but these abstract measures you have not very serious. It's a matter of disability.
If you add matter.
No matter.
They're still observable.
Sure. So you did not really eliminate values as a metric.
Don't admit.
If you call the metric what was background, then you did not entirely remove it.
No, I don't think that the metric is a background. The metric is, where am I going here? The metric is not background. The metric is dynamical.
So by removing the background, because one of your text points, you say you can.
Right. So the metric, the metric in special relativistic physics is background, and in general relativity it becomes dynamical.
So that is, you did not remove it; you just made it.
Yes. But it's a rather different object, and it's also noticed now it's not the metric anymore. It's the metric modulo of an infinite dimensional gauge group, which is the different one than the space one. Comments before we close out in Western or Guelph? Go ahead. We're not hearing you. We heard a question from Guelph, and now we're not hearing you. Yes. So let me repeat the question. And so the question is, you might consider also in the list of background the constants of nature, the 29 parameters of the standard model of particle physics, the 15 parameters of the standard cosmological models. And you might think that it would be a good idea to replace those with dynamics. Therefore, to have them not have a view that they just are specified for some reason once and for all eternally in the laws of physics, but that they are quantities, they do reflect quantities which can evolve dynamically, and that there is a lot of knowledge to be gained by applying the relational strategy to them and seeking to understand them as arising from something deeper and more dynamical. And that even seems to have succeeded to a large degree in string theory, that leading to the landscape of quote solutions to string theory or versions of string theory. And I, for one, suspect that that's generic. That is, I don't look forward to any other phase. In some sense, in a little bit different language, when you take a quantity and you move it from the absolute to the relational, you also move it from the necessary column to the contingent column. So the geometry of three-dimensional space is no longer just, for some reason, necessarily Euclidean. It's a solution to the Einstein equations, which raises the issue of which solution to the Einstein equations? Well, the one that determines our cosmology, but what picked that solution? What picked those initial conditions? So we have now a relational and contingent view of the metric rather than a absolute and necessary view, but it doesn't answer all the questions. It now raises questions of what were the initial conditions. Even if you think we know the laws by which they evolve. And similarly, if you make the parameters of the standard model of particle physics subject to dynamics under some evolution, then you have two questions. One, what are the laws by which they evolve? And two, what were the initial conditions of those laws? And that's part of the conundrum that I want to discuss as we go on. I mean, that's part of the conundrum, because it seems to me that is an issue about the notion of law and raises issues about the nature of time, which, if you remember, I raised back in the opening lecture, and which, to me, are So thank you for raising that. What I believe is that those issues are somehow connected with the more traditional issues about that we've been discussing in this class. Okay, other comments, questions? So as we go on, we will come back to those issues.
This relationalism is about just time and space, or about other things that, for example, manifold or mysteries here?
Sure. As formulated, that's why I formulated it this way. It's not just about time.
But, I mean, I think that if we believe in kind of rational relationalism, then it creates a false absolutism inside that. Because, for example, in my case, here we have dij, which is xi minus ej. But this distance, I mean, is an absolute case. It's not a relational. So if we use it as background, it can be an absolutism.
No. So what you might argue is that what's assumed when I say that these distances are meaningful is a measure, is a notion of what distances are. And you might seek to relationalize that.
Yeah, but I want to say that the relationalism, if we accept that, this is kind of absolute.
Well, I don't accept your absolute formulation of relationalism points back to absolutism or something. But every instant, but there are a succession of questions that are raised. So for example, you know, Julian Barber in his work the last 10 years or so raised the issue of why not the proof of scale transformation? Why not be able to locally, so the scale transformations where you change the metric by multiplying by a function which can stretch or shrink things arbitrarily. And why should we believe that we can parallel transport things around and compare their lengths? Maybe that is also a relational thing. And he introduced a set of theories which have a gauge invariance, which is local scale invariance. And he's discussed these with a group of colleagues. And I didn't plan to discuss that, but we could. Okay, I said we would end at 9, it's 9:30. But since we didn't take a break, I feel like I'm running out of energy if other people are not. Any last comment? Okay. What I propose to do, so please send me from Western those papers, and I'll email them to everybody. And along with what I propose to do next time is continue to discuss these issues. I want to talk about Mach's principle, which means I want to talk about inertia and gravity, which has been raised a couple of times, but which haven't been. So I want to talk particularly about that. And then I want to go back to the issue of time and law. So thank you very much.